Can we see that? Just the vote. I'm going to have to apologise in advance. I thought we might all be closer, so there is some small type on this. You've got no chance of seeing it, and I will read it out to you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I'm Pete Martin. I'm the creative director of The Gate Worldwide, and I'm here today to talk to you about the filthy business of creativity in a commercial context. I'm going to talk about creative process from an ad agency point of view. I'm probably going to start with a bit of background so you might understand where my views come from. But first of all, if you're not from around here, I'd like to welcome you to the country that, for obvious reasons, invented the rainproof coat. I hope the Scottish summer hasn't dampened your enthusiasm too much. I'm not from Edinburgh myself originally. I love the city, but I still find it a strange place. Other Scots describe it as all fur coat and no knickers, which suggests Edinburgh is a place keen on keeping up appearances. The phrase also sums up the city's Jekyll and Hyde character, I think. The rich Edinburgh, you can see it all around us. You know, the ornate buildings, the dreaming spires, the great minds of the Scottish Enlightenment. It all contrasts starkly with the city's dark, seamy side. Birkenhair, Deacon Brodie, and today the well-hidden Sink Estates and the not-so-well-hidden Sex Trade. It's a bit like New York. It's a snob town. And most people who live and work in the city don't really come from here. I was born and raised about 50 miles up north. My mum was a devout Catholic, a local Labour politician, a director of Perth Theatre, and a housewife in that order. And she was more likely to feed your mind than feed your appetite. Dad was an electrician and a workaholic. He left school at 14 and dragged himself up all the way from Glasgow's Gorbals to a nice council house in Perth, which in Scottish society is quite a long way. What I got from my mum and dad was the idea of personal progress and social justice. In the ad agency world, I think that made me a bit of a militant creative. I believe passionately that creative people should be fairly rewarded for the work they do. And sometimes in an ad agency, that's not always as easy as you think it's going to be good. I believe the best way to achieve that for a creative person is to take control of your own destiny and face up to some financial realities. And in my case, that meant I started my own ad agency. I worked hard to grow the business and sold it 10 years later to a PLC, thank God. However, my background also made me a bit schizophrenic, in the colloquial sense. In my career, I've worked for clients through big brand conglomerates like Unilever, the drinks giant Diageo, and Marks & Spencer. And when I worked in New York, we handled heavily with Wall Street institutions like Merrill Lynch and the NASDAQ, and yes, even those idiots, Lehman Brothers. But I've also been heavily involved in social inclusion issues such as mental health, early years initiatives like Play Talk Read, and the agenda for public health and well-being. So I'm also concerned how creativity and culture impacts on wider society, not just intelligentsia and culture at all, sitting in front of me today. I think we all know that much of what passes for art is seen as exclusive rather than inclusive, and that has big implications for audience development. While so many talented people struggle for an audience and a living, how can Simon Cowell predictably capture the attention of the public with such tripe and make off with so much money? I have many friends who are artists, some quite well known, most of whom could do with more financial stability in their lives. My own daughter is an actress, so it's a subject that's quite close to my heart as well as my wallet. So today, I'm mainly going to talk about the creative behaviours for sustainable careers. We might also be able to draw some inferences about audience development and the role of art in the well-being of society in a 10-15 minutes so far view. Next slide. What we're going to talk about is how a creative agency makes money, what clients buy, sustainable careers and agency process and what that means, and the strategies for success I've kind of seen in my career and things that I can tend towards failure, and then what that means for creative practice and talent development. So I'm going to blast through that as fast as I can. I apologise in advance if I make some egregious assumptions, but I tend to view everything as a market, and that might not be right. I don't really know much about the market for proper art, so I'm sorry about that. I'm also Scottish. If I start to talk too fast, shout out, and we'll see if we can get through reasonably painlessly. No doubt you've all seen Mad Men, the beautifully realised soap opera set in the 1960s ad agency. When I started working in agencies in the early 1980s, it was still sort of like that, but day, the account director sat there smoking a pipe. We had a couple of whiskey brands in the business, and so they each had a huge drinking culture. I don't remember there being much sex, at least I wasn't getting much, but there was a lot of sexism. I had a woman to type my copy, and a girl to make me coffee. And on a Friday, all of the men go to the pub all afternoon, while the women stayed in the office and typed. This nonsensical situation was only made possible by something called the commission system. From the dawn of the industrial era to the early 1990s, all agencies were commission agents. In Mad Men, Sterling Cooper is a commission agency. They get 15% commission on the cost of any ad they buy, any media they buy. So if you book a $1 million campaign in the press or on TV, you get £150,000. You know the little fat guy with the glasses in Mad Men and who books the media? That entire revenue stream has come from him, right? And that pays for all of the agency's creative services. So in that business model, there's very little direct relationship between the money you earn and the amount of work you do. And that had a huge bearing on the behaviour of the agency staff, as Don demonstrates in every episode. He's able to piss off and do what he does. The commission system broke down in the early 90s. The little fat guys with glasses broke away to become media independents. They charged the clients just 5%, 2%, 3% commission, and gave them the rest of the money back. Leaving the Don Drapers of this world without a revenue stream. And then we had to start charging clients fees for our time and stop drinking at lunchtime. And you know what? Clients don't like paying fees, and they become quite fussy about what they buy from agencies. Here's what they buy. We make ads and stuff, but fundamentally, clients want from an agency objectivity. This is the bit you won't be able to read, right? There's not a chance of reading it, but I'll tell you what it is, right? Objectivity. Most clients are too close to their own business to have a sane view of how to sell them to a disinterested public. John Steele is an English planning director of Goodways in San Francisco. And he tells a story about when he was a junior on the Club Chocolate Biscuit account in Britain. Everyone knows what Club Chocolate Biscuit is. It's a very chocolatey chocolate biscuit. And the client was enthusing about how they'd managed to put a micron of extra chocolate on the chocolate biscuit. And when the customer and the housewife saw how much chocolate was on the chocolate biscuit, they were going to break down the supermarket doors and load up on this chocolate biscuit. And the counter had leaned forward said, "It's all a fucking chocolate biscuit." So, objectivity is one of the things clients say. Clients do want creative concepts. They want ideas to differentiate themselves in the marketplace, and products are often very similar, and they want to connect to audiences. But the agency market is also crowded, and clients can see ideas as ten a penny. There's always a gap between the idea and the execution, so we need craft skills to make that happen, to add emotional resonance. It's often quite subjective, and clients don't really understand it, and they hate paying for it. So that little creative chunk in the middle can be quite high risk. The stuff at the bottom, technical and productivity, why we put the bottom part is like getting things done. Those are basically commodity services. You can get them anywhere, they're widely available, they're cheap, and so they're not very profitable either. What is odd, I think, is the top part is actually quite low risk. It's very hard to be wrong being a consultant. You just ask the client what he wants to know and then tell them. So even that one, I guess it's sometimes easier to make a living, you know, talking about art than making it. You can teach it, you can write books about it, but it's much harder. If you're in Sid Field, have you seen a good Sid Field movie? You know, he's a famous screen stopper. Well, he's not written a good screen, but he's written a lot of books about it. And maybe people live out of it. The strange thing about it is, in terms of agency practice, we get paid different amounts for what you do. And that value generally descends from top to bottom. But the odd thing about it, I've always found, is that it's exactly the opposite of the ladder by which people advance their career in a sustainable way. That directly influences the pay scale in an agency. I mean, if you're an art worker, this would take you to being an art worker. It's not particularly well paid, frankly. If you're a designer, you've got good craft skills, or you're a typographer, it takes you to there. If you're in the creative department, you're a good art director or copywriter, it takes you to there. And of course, once you become a creative director, you're vastly overpaid, you're at the top of the tree. It impacts on how people behave, because money talks, and it impacts on the creative practices that make for success and failure. Before I talk about creative agency process, Let's just talk about the mindset, I think, will keep you sane working for an agency. First of all, it's a job, often a very good job, and you bring the best of yourself to it, but it's not about you and your individual vision, and I'll come back to that point in a minute. Critically, you're trying to create something with reliable results. We're going to have an idea, which the client will sign off and which, when we implement it, will influence the behaviour of the audience in such a way that it can have an economic impact greater than its cost. And we're going to have that idea on Wednesday. You need an effective process to be able to do that, partly for project management, but also because your own personal taste is not a good guide to what will work. In an agency, young creative people realise very quick that their taste is not universal. Clients get to realise that, but young creative people learn it very fast. Things that we find funny and resonant often leave the suits and the clients cold and don't get through the system. The trouble is, you're hired because you think differently from most people, yet it comes as a shock that most people might see things differently from you. So most agency staffs are young liberal arts graduates, highly literate, highly visual, you're media savvy, outgoing, expressive, and huge chunks of the buying public ain't like that. You might see some parallels with audience development in the arts world, the danger of talking to ourselves, and the difficulty of attracting a wider, larger, more diverse audience. The idea of creativity as self-expression is embedded in our culture. But I think what we're usually talking about is cultural identification, which isn't always the same as creating a connection with somebody who's not like you. I would love to say that the answer is building from the individual to the universal, but it always causes huge hilarity in an agency whenever a client tries to tell us that their target audience is everyone. This is a depressing slide, so then you can see that. Much as we all like to consider ourselves as absolute individuals, the data suggests otherwise. There's about 22 million households in the UK. It's a postcode-driven nation. There's about 14 houses in a postcode, in case anybody cares. The big data companies are generally involved in credit scoring. They know a lot about you. They break the population in ultimately about 50 to 100 little clusters. Based on the type of house you stay in, financial status, lifestyle, media choices, consumption, through TGI, Cameo, all the rest of it. And the groups tend to be highly self-consistent in terms of consumer attitudes and behaviours, and yes, you're all in one of them. Agencies do use focus groups. It's generally a hugely flawed process. People don't know how they feel, don't say what they think, and don't do what they say. But clients love focus groups. And use the outputs like a drunk man leaning on a lamppost for support rather than illumination. But as the head of Sony once said, don't ask people what they want, they don't know. Instead, apply your brain power to what they need and will want and make sure you're there ready. And that's what any planning process is really about. The rest of the agency process is remarkably simple. I'll talk you through in a couple of slides. Deceptively simple, because a lot of the task is to stop agencies making it complicated. There's always a brief which codifies what's been agreed, acts as inspiration, and is a litmus test for any ideas. All agency briefs are more or less the same, frankly, and they vary visually and all the rest of it. There's usually about half a dozen questions. The only ones that really matter is what you're trying to achieve, who you're talking to, and what you want people to feel or think about the product. So what makes an effective idea? From an agency perspective, you're looking for a product focus, something that's in the product that is inherently true, something that can be evidenced. We look at something that's relevant to the consumer, and those are often quite different things. If you talk about beer, if you talk to a beer client, they want to talk about hops and barley and spring water, and people want to talk about getting drunk and getting laid. And then there's the final bit, what kind of makes a difference, what makes the communication work in the marketplace. Any effective idea blends those three together. And if you think about, any brand of Cadbury flake ad, what's the product truth? Only the crumb is flaky as chocolate. What do the consumer want to hear? Tastes like chocolate, never tasted before. The creative cut through, I think it was a young woman erotically eating a chocolate bar, if I remember. So you're trying to seamlessly blend those three things together. Unless you do that, the thing does not work. You will spend money, break your heart, and you get fired. I hate getting fired. There's a technique for producing ideas. Very small book written by James Byrd Young in the 1940s. He was the creative chief officer of JWT. He was the professor of business history at Chicago, and he was the head of propaganda for the USA during the war. And it's called A Technique for Producing Ideas. It is available. You can read it in about 20 minutes. It is fantastic. The process is incredibly simple, though. The first part is the hardest part, research. In other words, knowing a lot about the subject in hand. The second part is knowing a lot about other things for cross-fertilisation. Then comes the idea part. You just have to work very hard at it and keep trying and keep trying till your brain goes numb. Then you give up. You go to a movie, read a book, go to sleep, anything, and then later, when you least expect it, magically, without effort, the idea will appear. Then you need to let it lie for a while and come back to it just in case it's actually crap. In an agency, it's then my job to evaluate the creative work, just do sanity check and what the creative team have done. Usually, if there's any doubt, it revolves around that. Is it on brief? And if somebody brings a piece of work to me, I go, I'm not sure about it. I say, bring me the creative brief and we check, and I check it. Usually, if that's usually what it revolves around. They've actually had an idea and they like the idea and they don't like the creative brief anymore, and things start again. The other parts of it is kind of subjective, you know. Is this any good? Is it going to talk to the audience? Is it going to work? Have I seen something like it before? Did it work before? A good test of a good idea is if other things spin off it quite easily. See if it's hard to get a second idea off it. You'd go like, this is not going to work. Because nobody ever asks you for one idea. They want one, and then they want another one, and then they want another one. And they want a TV commercial, they want to press that, they want to post it, they want a website. So if the idea itself is quite limited and it only works in one thing, it's a real pain in the area. Will it work? This is based on experience, really. One of the greatest investors of all time, Sir John Templeton, said the four most dangerous words in investing are "this time is different." Is that you know, things that have failed in the past? Somebody says, "No, this time is different." So, no, it's not. You know, we're going to go through this process again. It's going to happen again. So that's a tricky one. Will the client buy it? This is often a line of call. Sometimes you've got a great idea and it makes sense and it then works, but you know in your heart of hearts the client ain't going to approve it. In a fee-driven environment, you're just wasting your time. If it's not going to get funded, you're all wasting your time. Nobody gets paid. That then takes you to what I think are the secrets of a successful, sustainable creative career. I worked with the cinematographer Seamus McGarvey. You know Seamus? Fantastic guy, did the cinematographer on Atonement. And I was speaking to Seamus about his career and, you know, how he got where he got. And I said, so what's your secret? He said, I know my exposures pretty well. which if anybody knows photography, it's hilariously humble. It's just ridiculous. But I'm sure he meant it. Technical skill is at the core of his craft. I'd also say that the most talented people I've met have also been exceptionally modest and unfailingly polite. They're also that astonishingly fast. Seamus is like lightning where he works. One of the reasons I think is that often we've got really great people with something up their sleeve, and they've got a reference, they've already had it, and they're just waiting for an opportunity to bring it out. So sometimes you've got a problem, and they go, hey, what, we need this. You think, wow, how did they do that? But they've already done it weeks ago, months ago, years ago. So really good. So being fast in a fee-driven environment makes you really successful, as does knowing a lot about it. And one of the best talks I ever heard was by a guy called Bob Barry. He was a fantastic art director at Fallon McGillicuddy, and his talk was called "The Client Killed My Ad, Thank God." And he showed all these fantastic ads he'd done, and he says they all got rejected. And then he showed you the work he developed afterwards, and said, "I'm just kind of better second time around." It's absolutely a question of attitude, which I think is really useful for people. I don't know if anybody knows William Goldman, the screenwriting genius. His famous phrase was, "No one knows nothing." And I think some of you might feel that you can't really predict with any certainty whether something will come good creatively at some point. You will have surprise hits and shock flops. But in reality, we can probably guess what will happen in most cases. The normal distribution curve applies. Freak occurrences happen at either end, but we mostly know what a strategy for success looks like. Plan for the best, prepare for the worst, do the likeliest. in my experience, I now know what a strategy for failure looks like as a creative. This will get you fired pretty fast, usually. We all know that pleasing yourself isn't particularly productive unless it's with a flake. The other thing that is quite strange, I once had somebody say to me, "Oh, he's really good, he's got a loud voice." That's crap. You know, he's got big red glasses on. Mistaking behavioural style for creative talent is quite common in the agency world. I once went to the Best of the Best Awards, which is like the best in global advertising. I wasn't getting one. But I got there and it's full of these incredible people, fancy suits and great, incredible looking. I thought, oh, these are big talents. So, wow. And a gentleman guy in a pair of gym shoes and a pair of jeans and a jumper was shuffling down at the stage for the awards. So I think it's really, really interesting. In a fee-driven business, there's just no value in being slow. The odd thing about it, I think it's related in some way to having an attitude to training. Some people don't know how they do what they do, and they're frightened that they find out that genius might flee. And that sounds is generally a recipe for good stuff, like that, I think. I haven't seen many tantrums in recent years, and partly because the business has changed and there's less drinking. But if I've ever questioned a piece of work and somebody's gone, "No, it's the best idea in the world," I then know, now I know you're wrong. Usually because you find that it's the only idea they've got. You don't have another one and they're not sure they can have another one, which in the agency context is being ideal. So folks, to sum up as fast as I can, what do I think that means for talent development? Most of it's really about creating clarity of purpose and audience focus with as few shocks and as little heartache as possible. Part of that is having a positive feedback model, an interesting feedback model. I can't really recommend highly enough a site called managertools.com, manager-tools.com, and they've got a feedback model they talk about, absolutely fantastic. And it's 40-minute podcast, there's about 10 of them, it's fantastic. Finally, I would say, if you're clear about your aims, are concerned primarily with your audience's needs, and are honest about the financial realities of your market, you'll create space for talent to flourish and for creative people to develop sustainable careers. And in my view, that's a return on investment you've